Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into something I think is really relevant for a lot of people. Creating a garden that looks fantastic, but is also, you know, smart about water use.
Yeah, being water wise.
Exactly. We've been looking at this guide, and it's just full of practical ways to transform your yard into, well, a low water landscape that actually flourishes.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission here is to pull out the really key insights for you, kind of a shortcut to getting informed on making your yard amazing and water efficient.
And the guide really drives home that this isn't about, like, sacrifice or having a barren yard. Not at all.
Right.
It's about making clever choices. Choices that lead to a landscape that's resilient, beautiful, conserves water, helps the environment, saves resources, and honestly, just creates a healthier, nicer space to be in.
Okay, so let's unpack that. The guide makes it super clear that the starting point, the absolute foundation, is the plants themselves.
Definitely.
What it calls water-wise planting. And it really highlights two main groups.
Mm-hmm.
Drought-tolerant plants and, importantly, native species.
Ugh, native plants. Yeah, the guide positions them as real heroes, and for good reason.
Why is that?
Well, think about it. They've spent, you know, ages adapting to your specific local conditions, the soil, the rainfall patterns. They're already dialed in.
Okay.
Which means, practically speaking, they need way less water, less fertilizer, just less fuss overall compared to plants from, say, totally different climates.
Makes sense. Less work.
And it's not just about them being tough. They play a crucial part in the local ecosystem, supporting pollinators, beneficial insects, birds. It's this great combination. Beautiful, hardy, and ecologically sound. A triple win, really.
The ecological angle is important.
Yeah.
So beyond natives, what actually makes any plant drought tolerant? The guide mentioned some pretty cool natural adaptations.
Oh, it's fascinating. Nature's engineering, like you said, some plants evolve these incredibly deep root systems searching way down for moisture.
Ah.
Others have thick, almost fleshy leaves, little water tanks, basically.
Like succulents.
Exactly, like succulents. And then you see plants with fuzzy textures or really small, thin leaves. Both strategies reduce water loss from the leaf surface. Less area exposed, or trapping a little layer of humidity right there. Pretty clever.
So cool. Okay, so the guide must give some examples, right? Some star performers.
It does. It points at some really popular ones like lavender. Everyone knows lavender. Loves sun. Needs well-drained soil. Those amazing purple spikes. And bees just flock to it.
Mm, love the smell of lavender.
Right. And then sedum, or stone crop. The guide calls them the camels of the plant world.
Okay.
Because they store water in those thick leaves. And the varieties, amazing, different shapes, sizes, colors, great for texture in dry, sunny spots. And they often look good year-round.
Nice. What else?
Echinacea, coneflower, those big, bold, daisy-like flowers. Butterflies adore them. Plus, they're just tough, adaptable plants.
Oh, yeah. Coneflowers are beautiful.
And the guide threw in a fun fact. Parts of echinacea were used historically in herbal remedies, supposedly to boost the immune system. And circling back to natives, the guide really emphasizes picking ones specific to your region. For the Pacific Northwest, for instance, it mentions Oregon grape, you know, with those holly-like leaves and yellow flowers, and red flowering currant. Gorgeous early spring color, and hummingbirds love it.
Oh.
Then there are ground covers like kinnikinnikilic evergreen, little pink flowers, red berries, and beech strawberry, and shrubs like serviceberry and salel.
So lots of options.
Tons. And remember, these aren't just saving water. They're providing food and habitat for local wildlife, making your garden part of the ecosystem.
That's a great point. Now, you mentioned planning.
Mm.
The guide brought up something called hydrozoning.
Yes, hydrozoning. It sounds technical, but the idea is really simple and smart. You just group plants together that have similar water needs.
Okay. Like putting all the thirsty ones together.
Exactly. Or all the super drought tolerant ones. Mm. It makes watering so much more efficient because you're not, you know, blasting water everywhere equally. You give each zone what it actually needs. No overwatering the tough guys just to keep the thirsty ones happy.
That makes perfect sense. Avoid waste. The guide had a table, didn't it? Water-wise wonders.
Yeah, handy little reference.
Looking at it, you see stuff like...
Go on.
Lavender. Perennial. Full sun. Low water needed once it's established.
Yep.
Key appeal. Fragrant flowers. Pollinators love it.
Check.
Sedum. Succulent. Full sun. Very low water, like you said. The camel. Appeal.
Mm.
Fleshy leaves. Great textures. Fall interest.
Yep.
Echinacea. Perennial. Full sun. Low to moderate water. Appeal.
Yeah.
Big, colorful flowers attracts butterflies.
Mm.
And I listed others, too, like blue fescue grass for its cool blue color, needing low water. and artemisia with silvery leaves, very low water needs.
Right, good textural plants.
And it loops back, noting that many of those natives we talked about, salvia, Oregon grape, red flowering currant, kinnikinick, beech, strawberry, they're all definitely on that water-wise wonders list, too.
Absolutely. Lots to choose from.
Okay, so picking the right plants is step one. Huge.
Yeah.
But the guide stresses that how you water is just as vital, right? Even tough plants need a drink sometimes, especially when they're new.
Crucial point. Efficient delivery is the name of the game. Getting water straight to the roots, not, you know, spraying the leaves or the pavement.
Which brings us to things like drip irrigation and soaker hoses. Mm. Targeted hydration.
Exactly. Drip irrigation. The guide describes it as almost a personalized watering system for your plants. It's this network of tubes, maybe some tiny emitters, that deliver water slowly, drip by drip, right at the base of the plant near the roots.
So very precise.
Very precise. And that means you lose way less water to evaporation or runoff. The benefits are pretty significant, according to the guide, potential water savings up to like 80% in some cases.
80%. Wow.
Plus, it keeps the soil moisture more consistent, which is great for healthy roots. It works for rows, containers, even slopes where sprinklers might cause runoff. And bonus, less water on the soil surface means fewer weeds popping up.
Okay, sounds good. Maybe complicated to set up.
The guide mentions there are actually lots of DIY kits available now, making it pretty accessible.
Okay. And what about soaker hoses? They sound simpler.
They generally are. Think of a hose made of porous stuff that just kind of weeps or sweats water out along its whole length.
Okay.
Definitely easier to install. You basically just lay it on the ground, maybe tuck it under some mulch. And usually they cost less upfront.
But there's a trade-off.
Yeah. The guide points out they're less precise. The water distribution might not be perfectly even. They can be more prone to clogging over time and maybe don't last quite as long as a good drip system.
So different tools for different jobs.
Pretty much. Drip is often better if you have individual plants dotted around. Or mixed beds, containers, definitely on slopes. Soaker hoses. They're a good economical choice for things like long, straight vegetable rows or on flat ground.
That comparison table in the guide really helps lay that out, looking at efficiency, precision, best uses, installation, maintenance. Helps you figure out what fits your garden setup.
Exactly. Your specific needs.
Now, speaking of smart wiring, the guide gets pretty enthusiastic about using, well, free water, rainwater harvesting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It frames it as this really elegant, sustainable idea, just collecting and storing the rain that lands on your property.
How does it work, basically?
Super simple concept, really. You need something to catch the rain, usually your roof, then a way to move it, gutters and downspouts,
right.
And finally, somewhere to store it, typically a rain barrel or maybe a larger tank.
And the benefits, aside from free water.
Big ones. First, you conserve municipal water, which is huge during dry spells or if there are watering restrictions. Second, you reduce stormwater runoff. When you capture that rain, less water floods into storm drains, which helps prevent local flooding and washes fewer pollutants into rivers and streams.
Good point.
Plus, rainwater itself is naturally soft, no chlorine or other chemicals like tap water. Plants tend to love it.
What do you use it for?
Irrigating the garden, topping up ponds, putting out water for birds or wildlife. The guide does suggest checking local rules. Sometimes there are guidelines or even incentives, but it really highlights starting with a simple rain barrel connected to a downspout. Easy first step, big impact.
Okay. Rain barrels. Got it. Now, for the tech lovers out there, the guide also dives into smart irrigation controllers.
Yes. Tech meets gardening. These are pretty clever devices.
How so?
They essentially use real-time information, things like local weather forecasts, data from soil moisture sensors you can put in your garden, even info you program in about your plant types and landscape conditions.
Okay.
To make really smart decisions about when your irrigation system should run and for how long.
So it waters automatically, but intelligently.
Exactly. Imagine your system knowing, hey, it's going to rain tomorrow, I'll skip watering today. Or, whoa, it's a heat wave, I need to adjust the schedule slightly. That's what smart controllers do.
That's pretty powerful.
It really is. The main benefits the guide lists are, first, major water savings, often 20 to 50% reduction in outdoor water use. That means lower water bills, too.
Nice.
Second, they help prevent both overwatering and underwatering, which leads to healthier plants and less chance of disease. And third, convenience. You can often set them up and let them do their thing, maybe managing them from an app on your phone. They handle complex stuff like calculating evapotranspiration rates automatically. Makes sophisticated watering much easier.
Okay, that's a lot on watering. So we've got the right plants, smart watering techniques,
Yeah.
but the guide says don't forget the basics underground. Mulch and healthy soil, calls them the unsung heroes.
Absolutely crucial. You can have the best plants and watering system, but if the foundation isn't right, let's talk mulch first. The guide calls it your garden's protective blanket.
I like that analogy. So what does this blanket do?
A whole bunch of important things. Primarily, it acts as a barrier on the soil surface, dramatically slowing down how quickly water evaporates. So moisture stays in the soil, available to the roots, for longer.
Makes sense. Keep the water in.
Right. It also suppresses weeds by blocking sunlight, so weeds don't germinate easily. Less competition for water and nutrients for your plants.
Always good to have fewer weeds.
Definitely. Mulch also helps regulate soil temperature. It insulates the soil, keeping roots a bit cooler in summer heat and warmer during colder periods. Roots appreciate that stability. And if you use organic mulches like wood chips or shredded bark as they slowly break down, they actually improve the soil itself by adding organic matter, boosting fertility and structure over time.
Oh, so it feeds the soil too.
Yep. And finally, it protects the soil surface from being pounded by rain or blown away by wind, preventing erosion.
Okay, lots of benefits. What kind of mulch? The guide mentioned types.
It did. It
Yeah.
generally leans towards organic mulches for garden beds, wood chicks, bark, straw, pine needles, even compost, precisely because they improve the soil as they decompose. But it also mentions inorganic options like gravel or rock, which can be useful, say, in really windy spots or for pathways.
And how do you apply it? Just dump it on.
Not quite. The guide recommends a layer about 2 to 4 inches deep. Key tip, though. Always pull the mulch back a few inches from the actual stems of your plants or the trunks of trees. You don't want it piled right up against them, as that can trap moisture and lead to rot.
Oh, okay. Good tip.
And ideally, apply it when the soil is already damp, like after a rain or watering, to seal that moisture in. The guide basically says consistent mulching is one of the best things you can do, high value, relatively low effort.
Got it. Mulch is a must-do. Now, building on that, soil health. The guide really hammers this home. Great gardens start from the ground up, right? It used that analogy of healthy soil being like a sponge.
That's such a good way to put it. Soil with good structure, good tilth, can soak up water easily when it rains or you irrigate.
Like a sponge.
Exactly. And then it holds on to that water, releasing it slowly to the plant roots as they need it. Poor soil, on the other hand. Maybe it's compacted clay, water just runs off. Or maybe it's super sandy and water just drains right through instantly. Neither is ideal.
So how do you get that spongy quality?
The secret ingredient, according to the guide, is organic matter. Adding things like compost, which it calls black gold for a reason, or well-rotted manure, or even shredded leaves you rake up in the fall.
And what does that organic matter do in the soil?
It works wonders in a couple of ways. In heavy, sticky clay soil, it helps break it up, creating spaces for air and water to move, improving drainage and aeration. In really loose, sandy soil, it acts like a binder, helping those sand particles cling together better and hold on to both water and nutrients that would otherwise just wash away.
So it helps both ends of the spectrum, clay and sand.
Precisely. The guide emphasizes that regularly amending your soil, building up that organic matter content, is a real investment. You're creating this rich, living foundation that not only supports better plant growth, but also acts as a natural water reservoir in itself. It makes the whole garden system more resilient and water efficient, less reliant on constant inputs.
A self-sufficient ecosystem, like you said earlier.
That's the goal.
Okay, so we've got the plants, the watering, the soil, and mulch. The guide then ties it all together with design, thinking about the layout. And it introduces this term, xeriscaping.
Right, xeriscaping. And the guide is quick to point out this doesn't automatically mean a garden full of rocks and cacti, unless, of course, that fits your local climate and what you like.
Okay, so what is it then?
It's more like a set of principles, a framework for creating landscapes that are beautiful, useful, and designed to thrive in your specific climate with minimal extra water. It's adaptable.
What are some of those key ideas?
Well, one big one is thoughtful planning, really observing your yard before you plant. Where's the sun? Where's the shade? Any slopes? How do you actually want to use this space? Doing this up front, the guide says, saves a lot of headaches and water waste later.
Planning prevents problems. Makes sense.
Another major principle, limit thirsty turf areas. Your traditional grassy lawn is usually the biggest water guzzler in the yard.
Oh, yeah.
So, xeriscaping suggests reducing the size of your lawn, maybe just keeping grass where you really need it for play or relaxing, or considering drought-resistant grass types. And it highlights all the great alternatives: expanding flower beds, using ground covers, adding a patio or deck space.
Or just letting the lawn go brown in summer.
That's an option too. The guide mentions letting it go dormant is perfectly fine. It'll green up again when the weather cools. And then that idea we already talked about, grouping plants wisely, hydrozoning is absolutely central to xeriscape design. Grouping by water needs for efficient irrigation.
Okay. The guide also made a point about surfaces, like driveways and paths. How do they fit in?
Yeah, it's easy to forget, but those hard surfaces play a big role in how water moves or doesn't move across your property. Your typical concrete driveway or asphalt path, water hits it and just runs off, usually towards the street or storm drain. It can't soak in.
Right, creating runoff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the guide introduces the idea of using permeable paving materials instead where possible. These are surfaces that actually allow rainwater to filter through them and soak into the ground beneath.
Like what? What are examples?
Things like special permeable pavers with gaps between them, using gravel for paths, wood chip walkways, even some specialized types of porous concrete or asphalt.
Interesting. And the benefit is.
Reduced runoff, obviously, which means less potential for localized flooding and less pollution getting washed into waterways. Plus, you're helping to replenish groundwater right there on your property. The guide suggests even small changes can make a difference, working with the natural water cycle instead of against it.
Let the rain soak in. Makes sense. One last design tip the guide mentioned was planting in layers.
Yes, planting in layers. Think ground covers close to the soil, then maybe some shrubs, then taller trees.
Okay. Why is that helpful for water?
A diverse, layered landscape actually intercepts more rainfall than, say, a flat single layer like a lawn. There are more leaves, stems, and surfaces for raindrops to land on and cling to. This slows down the water's journey to the ground, reduces the force of its impact, and gives it more time to soak gently into the soil instead of just running off.
So it manages the rainfall better.
Exactly. Plus, aesthetically, layering adds so much depth, texture, and visual interest to the garden design. It's a win-win.
Okay, wow. We've covered a lot of ground, from plants to pipes to paving. So putting it all together, what's the big takeaway here?
I think the biggest message from this guide is that creating a garden that's both genuinely beautiful and water-wise is totally doable and really rewarding.
That's not some impossible dream.
Not at all. It really boils down to making smart, informed choices, understanding your site, picking the right plants, watering efficiently, taking care of your soil.
And designing thoughtfully.
Exactly. By weaving all those strategies together, selecting plants suited to your area, using precise watering like drip or soakers, maybe harvesting rainwater, definitely mulching, and building up that soil and designing with water flow in mind, you really set yourself up for success.
Yeah, and the guides seem to emphasize that you don't have to do everything at once,
You
right?
absolutely not. Every little change makes a difference. Adding just a few drought-tolerant plants this year, great. Installing a rain barrel, fantastic. Just committing to keeping your beds mulched, that's a huge win. Start small, build momentum. It all adds up to a larger positive impact.
It feels like it's a process, maybe a journey of learning what works best in your own space.
For sure. It's about observation and adaptation. But the end result, the destination, is this wonderful, resilient outdoor space that looks great, feels good to be in, is kinder to the planet, and let's be honest, often requires less tedious work in the long run. So enjoy that process of creating it.
Definitely. And just to leave everyone with something to think about, there was this closing thought in the guide that really stuck with me. It pointed out how something as simple as installing a rain barrel does more than just save water. It connects your own backyard efforts directly to bigger environmental cycles and stewardship. You become this active participant in managing water, reducing the strain on shared resources.
That's a powerful way to frame it.
It made me wonder, thinking about all these strategies we discussed, what other seemingly small choices we make in our gardens might actually have similarly positive, far-reaching impacts we don't always consider. Something to mull over.